Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Surgery Steering Follow-Up Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded. All lines will be open throughout today's conference, so please use your mute button. At this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Melinda Murphy. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and I would like to have Dr. Torchiana, and I'm sorry I did not hear Dr. Morris. Arden, are you on? Okay, so Dr. Torchiana, I wanted to see if you had any comments before we started.
Well, my principal comment is that I apologize for missing the meeting in Washington. I was sicker than I've ever been in my life. I lost 13 pounds, which is cosmetically positive, but it was really a miserable run. So I feel like I have a lot of loose ends to catch up on, and that would be my sole introduction, that I'm sorry I didn't make it to that meeting, and I will be better in future.
And when you get to the meeting, you will be delighted. It is a great committee, and you will enjoy the time with them face-to-face.
I'm looking forward to it.
So today the objective is to be able to have the committee take a look at the responses to the comments and questions that the members posed to developers around a few of the measures under consideration. And then once you've been able to hear those, what we will need to do is for a few of them, six total, we'll need to get a response from the committee in terms of three that were recommended with conditions about which we will hear information today, and then we'll be able to register your vote or opinion about whether or not the responses have satisfied the conditions that you placed upon those three measures. 0, 129, 131, and 134, and then an additional three measures upon which there was not a vote, 113, 114, and 300. 113 and 114 will go out, at least we anticipate, in a SurveyMonkey for your response, and we'll do the same thing with the ones that were recommended with conditions. The 300, if you recall, there was a commitment to have a discussion with the technical panel, the CMS technical panel, related to that one, and that could not occur until April. So we will actually take that one up at the May meeting, at near the top of the meeting, in order to complete the work on that one. So, again, today's discussion is dedicated to reviewing the responses and hearing from the developer representatives who are on the call with us today to address those comments and questions, and then move forward to the May meeting. So that's the sole purpose for today's meeting. Alexis, other details to add?
No, I have nothing else to add.
So with that, Dr. Torchiana, we would turn it to you to see how you wanted to proceed through whatever, and Alexis, you and Jessica will need to speak to what you've got on the screen because I cannot see it.
Okay.
So I have paper in hand, and I have the screen up as well. I would imagine that it makes – is everyone else on the webinar screen, or is there a mixture of modalities that people are looking at?
Well, I didn't know – this is Arden. I didn't know we had a webinar screen. Maybe I missed that. I'm just looking at the stuff that was attached to our email. Is there another screen as well?
So, yeah, there is a webinar site that's on the top of the agenda page that you were emailed. An NQF webinar site. It's myeventpartner.com / NQF Forum 41.
Thanks for letting me know. I'm just trying to connect it right now.
It takes a minute or so to get in. But I would imagine if everybody is looking at the same material, that the logical thing to do would be to proceed through through that order.
Sounds good. This is Terry. I have it up.
This is Dennis. I have it up.
And who's in charge of flipping the pages?
This is Jessica. I'm in charge of the webinar, so let me know if you need me to go faster or slower.
Okay, so right now we're looking at a table of contents page, and I would assume we should just immediately go into the substance and basically address the items, unless there's some way of organizing, and I'm probably the least informed member of this group, unless there's some other way of organizing the material into sort of coherent groups, I would imagine we go through the items one by one.
That's probably easiest and most straightforward.
So that would mean we go right to page 2, which is the one on the venous thromboembolism prophylaxis. And there the concern raised is as documented that the length of stay form was inconsistent, and I guess we should ask for comments on the developer's response. Does this seem like an adequate response?
Who was it that looked over this particular measure? I can't recall now. Who was the person who spearheaded the conversation about this measure?
And who raised the concern particularly?
This was
Christine, maybe?
Is Christine on the line?
Hi, yes, I'm on the line. Unfortunately, I don't have the webinar access. I'm just on the phone. Could you tell me what measure we're talking about?
It's 218, and it's just basically, we're just on page 2 of the PDF that was sent out with the email, I think yesterday or the day before.
So it's the page right after the agenda.
I'm driving right now.
Don't read it.
Well, can you tell me what the measure is, please?
Yeah, I can read out the concern. So it's the concern that was raised. This is about appropriate venous thromboembolism prophylaxis. And the concern that was raised is that the length of stay indicated on the form was inconsistent, that it's listed as 3 days in some areas of the form and 24 hours in other areas. The developer's response was that the time window is 24 hours prior to incision to 24 hours after surgery end time, and included in the measure submission is an exclusion statement that patients with hospital length of stay less than or equal to 3 calendar days. It is not consistent with the exclusion statement in the paired measure, which is 217, but it is the correct statement. So 217 needs to be corrected, not 218 is basically what the developer is saying.
Okay. Yeah, I remember the discussion, and that was the concern that those were not in conjunction using the same time limits. So if it's corrected in 217, and then it sounds like the 3 day is really referring to something else that's in the exclusion criteria.
And what they're planning on doing is dropping 217. They're not considering it for re-endorsement. So it's simply going to be dropped, and then there will be no inconsistency.
Yeah,
so
I think I had 217 and somebody else in the group had 218. But that's correct, and that's acceptable to me.
Okay. So,
thank you. Thanks for reading it.
You're welcome, and drive carefully, please.
Yeah, I should in 10 minutes be at a destination where I can see the PDF.
So the next one is a numerator detail on the same 218, and it's asking for a more detailed definition of what constitutes appropriate VTE prophylaxis and attempt to reconcile the guidelines with other evidence-based guidelines for relevant populations, like the difference between orthopedics and, I guess, ACCP. I'm not sure what that stands for. So there is a fairly detailed developer response. Chris, were you the same person who raised this concern?
This is Jim Carpenter. I was the one that raised this.
Okay.
Since I'm part of the American member of the orthopedic group, so I'm familiar with that.
So could you comment on the developer's response?
I think it's reasonable response. I think that's their position. I would hope, and I think as a whole, this is an important measure and should continue to be endorsed. I think that what I would hope would happen was they would work together to come to an agreement about what are appropriate guidelines. And so I think that this helps us reinforce that goal that that we should accept this, and this is a reasonable, logical reasoning for their position. But I think it helps explain or helps us encourage them to work out what a universally accepted definition for acceptable treatment is. So I think it's acceptable response.
Any other comments from the group?
It's not practical in this time frame for them to actually work this out.
Sure. But it adequately, for the time being, addresses the issue that you raise. It certainly makes them more consistent with one another.
Well, it doesn't change that, really. It just explains their reasoning for choosing the chest position guidelines over other guidelines because of level 1 versus level 3 evidence.
And that's okay.
That's a logical reasoning. We'd like to hear, I mean, personally, I'd like to hear them say, this will continue to be worked on with these groups to come to terms with guidelines.
This is Dan Rassler. I make it clear that we actually meet with the guideline authors, which includes AAOS representatives, quarterly for all of these measures. And as new guidelines are published, we do update the measures.
So are we happy with what's in the response, and we're able to proceed with this one?
Yeah, I think that's as good as we can do right now.
Yes. Okay. So the next one again on 0218, there was another concern around denominator exclusion details, and it was asking for a more detailed definition of the laparoscopic exclusion, or requested that laparoscopic procedures be removed as a denominator exclusion. And the developer response was to remove the exclusion. So laparoscopic will not be removed.
This is John Morton. I didn't get that exactly. So the exclusion is removed. Is that right?
Exactly. So laparoscopic procedures as of 1/1/2012 will be included.
Yeah.
Great.
That's perfect.
Great.
So we're now on to page 3. If we could advance the webinar. This is 0300. Cardiac patients with controlled 6 a.m. postoperative serum glucose. And the numerator statement was that the time frame should be within 24 hours of surgery instead of 6 a.m. And the developer response was that this was going to be presented to the SCIP infection group on April 6th, which is next week.
Yeah, this is Dale Bransler. So the committee's concern was that the big issue, I think, on the measure was not the issue about supporting glucose control for cardiac surgery. It was about the data collection as the measure at the moment arbitrarily chose 6 a.m., the closest blood sugar to 6 a.m. And the committee argued that, if you had a surgery that ended at 1 a.m., why, that might not be a reasonable time frame to get the patient's blood sugar under control. We've spent some time looking at the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, who now have a formal guideline on glucose control for cardiac surgery that clearly gives a level 1 recommendation to glucose control for cardiac surgery and actually has a tighter target of 180 milligrams per deciliter as the target upper range for blood sugar in cardiac surgery patients. So we're meeting with the technical expert panel, which includes representation from the STS guideline committee next week to review revisions to the measure, which may include targeting 180 milligrams per deciliter as the target, but then rethinking how we define acceptable glucose control. So one of the suggestions by the committee was to use a time frame that was 24 hours after the end of surgery. Some of our members have felt that 24 hours was too long, that 12 hours was more reasonable, or exploring if there are other ways to look at more than one blood sugar without creating data collection burden that's unreasonable. So I can't tell you exactly what we're going to come out with, but we're meeting with that group next week.
And it will be both about the timing and also the level.
Yeah, so I mean, we think it's reasonable to stay consistent with published guidelines, particularly when they give a level one guideline recommendation to that.
Any other comments on this?
Dr. Turchin, it's Melinda. This is the piece that we anticipated holding for the May meeting so that there would be the information back from the technical panel.
Very good. So on the same measure.
Hello?
Somebody join us?
Yeah, it's John Morton. I just wanted to chime in about the timing aspect because that is something that's been very difficult for people to achieve. And the 6 a.m. has been fairly arbitrarily set. And with cases going on all times of day, it seems like it would be better to have an open-ended time frame. And that's my understanding. That's what will be brought up. But I do want to reinforce 6 a.m. seems arbitrary to everyone, at least to us.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, we agree, and we stated right up front it was arbitrary, and that was done solely for data burden. So we're certainly willing to consider options. It's just the 24-hour option wasn't completely acceptable to some of the members of the panel. But again, we're going to have the formal conversation next week and include STS as part of that conversation.
So the next question on this measure was a more detailed definition of perioperative death. Do we have someone have an expert comment from the point of view of the issues raised in the developer response?
Yeah, it's Renee Stafford. That was one of my concerns at the meeting. Just that there really was no good definition for what that meant, and I think that they've answered that clearly in their response, and also included the fact that if patients go directly to the ICU, they have a perioperative time window. So I think that's appropriate.
Any other concerns? Okay. So we can now move down to 0113. And the question raised here is a more detailed description that addresses requirements for participation. And I'll read what the response was. Who raised this question? I think it was more than one person, as I recall.
Yeah, there are several people who raised the concern. I think, is Bob Seema on the line? He was the one who probably put it most succinctly, but there was concern in many quarters about the necessity of belonging to participating in the STS database and how problems had come up with that very recently in Florida, I believe.
So the response is to change the measure description so that there is not a requirement. Now it's interesting, in Massachusetts, where I practice, it actually is required by state regulations. But certainly the SDS does not require it as a part of its approach to its membership. And so changing the measure to read participation in a database with broad state, regional, or national representation, that certainly addresses the issue that we discussed about the Northern New England group or the New York State group, which does not use the STS database. But it's also a somewhat vague description of what an alternative to the STS database is. Is this satisfactory to the group?
This is Christine Zambricki, and I spoke to this issue at the meeting, and that would be satisfactory. I think
okay.
we had asked that if there was any information about the various databases that could be available to the group as background information, that would be helpful, but that is satisfactory that it is not required to be STS.
And
it has to be regional
the
or national.
Performance reports based on benchmark data, that's the essence of the...
Yeah, so I was there. This is John Morton. I was there with Bob when, you know, all this stuff was being raised. And I think the main issue is that there are other databases that have similar sort of statistical rigor, namely NISQIP. And I think the one thing that Bob wanted to get across, and I agree with him, is that we just want to make sure that if there's a good database out there that also fulfills requirement, that that can be employed as well, that it's not a single vendor.
I think that there were, you know, there were a lot of concerns about this. This is Arden Morris, and our conversation went on for some time, and then we touched back on this as we looked at some of the other measures, and this might be one that we should actually plan to discuss when the entire group is here, because there was such there were such strong opinions about it.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem pretty clear that there are two issues here. The first one is not to be exclusionary, that there are other very good vehicles, NISQIP, New York State, et cetera. But then on the other end, to make sure that the bar is not set very low, that a sort of very perfunctory enterprise would qualify to the same level as these much more sophisticated efforts do. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I'd say that's lacking from this definition, which I think is conceivably important, is that in addition to providing regular performance report based on benchmark data, might be to add the notion that some form of auditing is also important for credibility.
I think that's a great point. I think that this has the potential to be, what we decide on this has the potential to really to be far-reaching in the future, particularly as ACS NISQIP gains additional hospitals or makes a play for additional hospitals, and that there will be some competition between different database providers. That is happening now, and it's going to happen more. So being thoughtful about our decision here makes sense to me, since there will be repercussions.
Well, this one, I would agree, should stay open-ended if we could asterisk it for further discussion.
This is Dave Sheehan, one of the developers. Could I make a comment?
Sure.
The issue of ACS NISQIP in regard to cardiac surgery is really a non-issue. We work very closely with all the people at ACS, Cliff Coe, David Hoyt, Bruce Hall. They have no intention to develop a cardiac measure.
This is Terry. As I heard the conversation in Washington, it had to do with whether NQF should be in a position of endorsing either overtly or not so overtly a given program, whether it's STS or whatever. On the positive side is that it would make life, I think, a little more simple for NQF and those who participate in NQF, because they would have one process to oversee versus this issue of should they pick a favorite and should they sort of be in a position, should that be an activity the NQF should participate in. So, as has already been stated, this, I think, should and will come up again and deserves to have a broader discussion, because it has implications far beyond whether it should be SDS or NISQIP or whatever.
Hi, this is Alan Sipperstein. I just want to add to that I agree that I think this is kind of a very large overarching concern as quality metrics moves forward, because we're evolving into a system where we have multiple, don't want to quite use the word competing, databases with slightly different field definitions. And, you know, from a hospital perspective, you know, we are marching to a number of different drummers. And in an ideal world, we would have a single, clearly defined data repository then that multiple groups then could use. And, you know, at first blush, this doesn't really fall under specific measure approval, but is really, I think, a global, very important issue to address for overall quality.
Hi, this is Rick Dutton. I agree that we should not endorse any particular vendor because technology changes very fast and it could easily make us out of date.
So I think these are all great points, and they all, I think, lead to the conclusion that this is going to be a hardy perennial, and there'll be lots of discussion on this one, and it probably will be recurrent. So I would suggest that we move on to the next question on this point, which is the request that data be provided on disparities. And here the developer response is that the STS is not sure how to provide disparities data on this particular measure. And so I wonder if an interested person who raised this issue could comment here.
I think that their reply, this is Arden Morris, that the reply we received from STS at the time of our meeting was that the disparities data could be made available. And so we asked, okay, if it can be made available, will you make it available? Because that was one of the core missions of the NQF. Am I correct, Melinda, in understanding that?
You are. The expectation is, particularly with those measures that have been endorsed and in use over time, that the developers be able to provide some information back about disparities that they have learned during the implementation of the measure. With respect to this particular measure, I understand the response from STS, and I guess one of the things that I would ask if STS has available, perhaps if this would be of an interest to the committee, it likely would be of interest to NQF, is whether or not there are some provider groups, organizations that you have been able to see that do or do not participate in any particular characteristics about those as a type of disparity.
This is Dave Sheehan. I can only tell you that we have 95% of the programs in the country right now.
But, Dave, do you know if the 5% you don't have are all poor inner-city hospitals?
I think the 5% we don't have are predominantly in areas where there are other databases, New York, Northern New England. We have no evidence about the location of the programs we don't have. But given the fact that we have 95% of the programs in the country, I think we can safely say that we have a large proportion of all poor inner-city hospitals.
If this is Terry again, if you know that you have 95%, you must have a list of 100%. It should be relatively easy to find the 5% that you don't have.
Well, if that's what you'd like us to do, we will make an attempt to do that.
It's not a request. It was just a comment. I actually believe that you have broad representation, but I just that's all.
Point well taken.
So, if the STS is not sure how to provide disparities data on this measure, do you have any plan? Have you guys thought about it? Since it's one of the core missions of the NQF.
Well, I think it's very useful to have disparity information on the performance on various measures across population groups. I'm a little less uncertain, given the extremely broad representation of the STS database nationally. It's a little unclear to me how disparities information is going to be valuable for this particular measure.
But if it's possible to look at it and basically confirm that statement, then obviously that would be a useful thing to be able to come back with. So I think everyone's point is clear on this one. So let's go to the next one, which is the numerator statement. It appears to me that's simply being modified in the same way as the first issue raised on the participation, with the same language, dropping the requirement language and modifying the numerator statement to include other clinical databases. So I would assume that response is satisfactory. So let's then go to the numerator details on our hospitals required to report 100% of cases. David, maybe you could, are you familiar with the developer response here?
So this is numerator details number 4 under measure 113.
It's numerator details number, it's on the next page. It's the one that says our hospital is required to report 100% of cases.
And the answer is yes. And in fact, that is part of our audit process. We audit the cases submitted against hospital logs to be certain that all cases have been submitted.
And the hospital logs are like a discharge data set, is that the...
Yes, this would be the standard electronic registry that all hospitals have of the cases that have been performed.
Okay. So is that a sufficient answer to the question and concern that was raised?
Yes.
So risk-adjusted post-op renal failure, 0114. Disparities question. Looks like the answer is pretty succinct. That data on disparities are provided in the form.
Is the person who handled this measure on the line?
Yeah, it's Renee. I did, and as long as it's in the form, I think that's fine. I think the whole disparities issue, as everybody mentioned previously, is going to come up more and more, and it's going to be not just having the data, but how they used it. You know, have they then developed or focused efforts in certain places to look at that? So, but I think the answer for this is fine as long as we have the data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the next concern, numerator statement. Statement does not indicate participation is required. And the answer, again, we've covered this one. This one's,
right.
I think, taken care of then. So the next one, time window. Provide the time period in which cases are eligible for inclusion in the numerator. And the answer there is during the hospitalization, even if over 30 days.
That's perfect.
Perfect.
Next one, a more detailed definition of renal failure. David, could you comment?
Well, the suggestion was made that we change our definition to the RIFL criteria, which are becoming the national standard. And the question was asked why we had chosen the criteria that we currently have. And it's basically for consistency with decades now of historical data. But given the concerns of the committee, we have changed to the RIFL criteria with the exception of the fact that we will not have the long-term data, but in terms of the other criteria, we will use the RIFL criteria. And we will make those changes in our composite measure as well and in our reports back. That'll all take a few months to implement, but the ball's already in motion.
Yeah, David, it's Renee. I think that's great. I know this was one of my big things, and I think the committee all was pretty much behind that. And I think it, in the long run, will give everybody more useful benchmarking data to look at. So I applaud you all for actually making this happen.
Not a problem. Good suggestion.
Any other concerns on that one? That's historically been a very complicated field in cardiac surgery. Okay, reoperated patients included, the answer is yes. Cost to implement the measure, cost of data abstraction needs to be clear. This is not answered as a cost, but I presume the cost of an FTE varies geographically a bit, but one per 500 cases, is that a sufficient answer?
Yep, that's all we needed.
Okay.
Just so that they could have some data to give places when they're talking about looking at who they were going to have to hire.
Okay, so on surgical re-exploration, data by disparities, on disparities by population group, so that is on the form, and then numerator time window, time period in which cases are eligible is the entire hospitalization. So this is a broad definition of re-exploration. It is not just an immediate, within 12 or 24 hours of surgery definition. You want to comment on that at all, David?
No.
Has the STS considered separating two different re-exploration categories?
It's probably not necessary because you probably capture the reason
right.
for re-exploration.
Yeah, we capture all the re-explorations. The ones that are included in this particular measure were the major cardiac re-operations.
Mm-hmm.
We capture all the reasons, though, if a patient comes back for a trach or a PEG or something, a second operation during the same hospitalization, that's considered separately.
Okay, very good. So we move on to antiplatelet medication 0116. Same answer on the disparities question, that the data is on the form. And then a question raised on denominator exclusions with respect to calculating the numerator. Looks like the explanation is pretty straightforward. Any concerns on the response?
Nope.
Okay. A time period in which cases are eligible, and the response is that time period is indicated in the measure. Does that need any more clarification?
In other words, it's what was given at the time of discharge, by definition.
Okay. So then the acceptability of Plavix when applicable throughout, and David, could you detail?
Yeah, we accept aspirin or other similar platelet inhibitors, including Plavix.
That works.
Satisfactory, okay. Disparities, same answer with anti-libitid and with operative mortality and with operative mortality for AVR, mitral valve replacement, mitral valve CABG, AVR CABG. Now, so we're on to prolonged intubation, 0129. Please consider change in time limit to a period that is less than 24 hours.
We recognize that it is possible and desirable in many patients to extubate sometimes in the operating room, many times within a few hours. On the other hand, as a routine performance measure, we believe that 24 hours is an appropriate time period.
Comments, concerns about that?
This is Terry. I'm harking into my pulmonary days. I understand the complexity of post-surgery patients. On the other hand, if you set a timeline where the vast majority of people are going to make it, then it doesn't become very discriminatory. And I think 24 hours for this is not a particularly helpful threshold. I don't think it's going to tell us anything. So I'm not sure what the exact goal is of these measures, but I don't think this one would be very discriminatory.
Well, remember that the measure is not, it is desirable to extubate patients within 3 hours after surgery. The measure is trying to identify a set of patients that are prolonged, that have prolonged ventilation, usually because they've had, this is usually a metric for, or a proxy for, other issues. They're hemodynamically unstable, they've been re-explored, they've had a stroke, they're comatose, and occasionally they are patients with severe pre-existing, pulmonary disease. But this is, we're trying to identify here the patient that has had an exceptional period of intubation.
Do you have a sense of how many, of what proportion of patients in your database that is in the last few years?
Jane, do you Donna, do you have that offhand?
Not offhand. I can look at the form. It should be provided in there.
It's single digits, Dave?
I would think probably, I would have guessed 10% or so, but I'm probably going to be proven wrong as soon as she finds it. So it's a fairly low number.
We discussed this, and I can't recall if we discussed the actual number when we were in our group, but some of these, we were concerned that they weren't adequately discriminatory because they were basically topped out, and this might have been one of them. I don't remember exactly. Does anybody else remember?
We did, it's Renee, we did talk about that. It is, if I remember correctly, I don't have the rest of the data in front of me, it is relatively topped out. The other part of the discussion was, it does get back to that discriminatory piece and the fact that, you know, at least those of us who were there at the meeting that knew about our own institutions found that many of these patients are extubated right away. And so that was why we brought that up as a topic for discussion. And would it be a better measure? And recognizing, as the developers have clearly stated, that there are adverse unintended consequences of anything when we're looking at measures, et cetera. I mean, clearly you wouldn't want somebody extubated just because it's a benchmark unless they're ready to be extubated.
Did everybody want me to share, this is Jane from STS, the risk-adjusted rates for prolonged intubation that we have provided?
Please.
For the mean is 11.5% and the median is 10.6%.
Yeah, it wasn't too far off.
No.
Yeah, we'll start at 0.6.
And David, has there been talk? I know when people study this question that they oftentimes look at a 24-hour period, but also a mean and median period of extubation, excluding the 24-hour plus intubations. And is there any consideration of pairing those two together, which I think would address the question here?
I haven't discussed that, George, but a reasonable idea. Again, I think what we were really... I think we're talking about two somewhat subtly different goals here. Our goal was to try to identify that subset of patients that are being ventilated, not just a few hours over the optimal, but that subset of patients that really, typically it's not just 24 hours, it's probably 48 or 72. The patients that are in the ICU for days or week for various reasons. The intent of the measure was not the same as a measure that, for example, would say a percentage of patients extubated within 6 hours. That would be an entirely different goal of rapid extubation. So I think a slightly different focus of those two different ways of approaching this.
So could the members of the group that raised concerns suggest a pathway forward here? Are we content with leaving this as is because of what it sounds like a pretty good explanation for why this is the measure as it's currently stated. Should we recommend that something around intubation time without the outliers be considered as an additional metric to complement this one?
I like that latter thought.
Yeah, I do as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So let's move on. We have, again, a number of disparities provided on the form responses till we get to 131, risk-adjusted stroke cerebral vascular accident. And this one asks for the time period in which cases are eligible for inclusion in the numerator. And this response, again, is during hospitalization, which includes the entire post-operative period up to discharge, even if over 30 days. That seems like a pretty concise and precise answer. That's satisfactory?
Yes.
Okay. So then denominator exclusion, please reconsider exclusion of patients with prior CVA or explain the rationale. And it is in the risk model, and so the response has been that STS will remove this exclusion.
Great.
Use of IMA disparities, it's on the form. Please remove the IMA is not a suitable conduit due to size or flow from the exclusions. And STS agreed to this during the steering committee meeting, and the form's been modified.
Excellent.
Great.
Risk-adjusted operative mortality for mitral valve repair, does it apply to open chest procedures? It applies to mitral valve repair regardless of approach. And then disparities are on the form for the next two. And then overall, question concern raised by steering committee on plan for public reporting. David, would you comment?
Sure. Well, I think as everybody knows, we initiated public reporting in September of last year with consumer reports. This January, we implemented the same on our website. Thus far, we've been reporting on CABG using the STS CABG composite. We are, as we speak, developing an aortic valve composite, which will be based solely on outcomes. It will be the five most common complications of aortic valve isolated aortic valve replacement plus mortality, all risk adjusted. That will be developed this year and reported starting next year. Every year we plan to roll out one additional procedure, so I anticipate that probably the year after isolated aortic valve replacement will probably be another very common procedure, which is mitral valve repair. So that's the general plan.
Comments?
Sounds good to me.
David, if I could ask, the first Consumer Reports publication on CABG, I think was, my recollection is it was about 20% of U.S. centers. Has there been any signs that's moving to a higher percent? Has that stimulated interest and debate and enthusiasm?
Well, it's very interesting. It's now, 5 months after we've had a huge amount of interest, and happy to report that we are now up to 351 participants, which is about 35%.
Cool.
So that's a very substantial increase.
Okay. Other comments, thoughts? Okay. Well, it appears as though we are through the specifics on the measures, because it looks to me like what's next on my list was just sort of an appendix detail for the thromboembolism measures. And so, as I look at the agenda, the next step would be for NQF member or public comment, unless there's something that I'm missing that Alexis would like to correct me on.
No, you're good.
So could we ask for the lines to be open for member or public comment?
All lines are open at this time.
Okay. Well, certainly being allowing anyone to chime in as the call goes on, but hearing none, I would ask that we go to the next steps on the agenda.
It's Melinda. So what we'll do now is continue with the preparation for the May face-to-face meeting based on the discussion today. Measure 113, which is the participation in the database, will be discussed at that meeting. And as it was planned, also in terms of other related measures. So if I understand that the will of the group, your pleasure would be that there be no vote held on this until the May meeting. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other measure that we'll hear additional information about is 300 from CMS, where they will bring the information that they get from their call later this week with their technical panel. So, Alexis, then maybe I would want to turn to you to say, what will happen next in terms of SurveyMonkey and other activities of the group?
For the remaining measures, we can, if you'd like, we can do it via SurveyMonkey, or if you want to do the vote in person at the May 4th and 5th meeting, we can do it that way. It's pretty much up to the committee what you would prefer.
I would prefer in person.
There's a lot of stuff that came out of our discussion that we weren't that we were coming up with together, but not necessarily individually.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So we'll carry it forward to the May meeting for a vote. And what Alexis and I should tell you is that day one of that meeting in May is going to be a long day. But if we do a long day on the first day, we'll be able to get you out by about the 3:30 time on the second day. So just need to declare up front, day one's going to be grueling.
Well, you guys thought it was going to be long the last time, too.
Yeah, okay, true.
Should I bring my Depend?
Alexis, anything else?
The only thing I will add is that next week we will be sending you the phase two measures along with the measure submission forms and the measure assignments, and it's going to be the same process that it was for the phase one measures. You will submit your preliminary evaluations via SurveyMonkey. And so for phase two, we have a total of 39 measures to review and discuss and evaluate.
This is Terry. Is there something different about phase two to which we should pay attention, or is it pretty much the same process, Alexis?
It is the same process. For phase two, what we did, we took the themes from the phase one in-person meeting, and we went back to the measure developers and asked
okay.
them to go back and clarify some information, especially the disparities. If it was not indicated in the form, we went back to the measure developers and asked them to provide that information, as well as update article citations and reference citations if they were 10, 20 years, and if they were submitted during the original submission for the maintenance measures. So we tried to go back to the measure developers to make sure that you have the adequate information to review the measures.
Okay, so the same measures, they just have been buffed up per our request.
Yes.
Got it. Thank you.
You know, this is Arden. I'd like to say something about that. My understanding of the NQF's bringing up equity and disparities is because they want for that stuff to actually get measured, and they want to see what the actual results are. And I think that it's that the NQF should decide if just being told that that there is a space on the form for people to indicate their race, gender, age, or whatever. Is that adequate? Does that fulfill what the NQF had in mind, or did the NQF want actual information? Because the STS initially, in their response to us about these items, had said that they could get that information. They just hadn't done it yet. Now, they still are basically saying that they can get the information, but they haven't done it. If that fulfills what the NQF is after, okay. But if it doesn't, then I think that we should attend to it.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, there's a number of STS reports, because I was co-author of one, on looking at disparities based on data from the STS database.
Mm-hmm. So they've generated the reports, and they can extract those numbers from the reports and tell us as a committee what they are.
Well, we've provided those in the form.
We actually provided that information in the form, so they're in there for you. We ran it for all 21 measures. The only thing about the database measures that we didn't know how to present it to you to make it meaningful, and so we were asking for feedback on that so we can go back to our data warehouse and ask them to run numbers. But all that information we have access to, and that has been provided in the updated forms, and I know Alexis and Melinda can provide that for you, including the phase two measures.
Okay, so as a committee, I think that we need to sort of figure out as a committee, are we fulfilling what the NQF, among the members of the committee, are we fulfilling what the NQF is after with bringing that up? And I guess we need information from the NQF about that.
And Dr. Morris, it's Melinda. One of the ways in which you'll be able to speak to that is whenever we get to the phase of the work where the group is looking at gaps, there will be the opportunity to take a look at, are there some gaps, are there some issues around disparities that the group would recommend that there need to be measures or additional discriminating information within existing measures to look at where the disparities are. So I believe, one, yes, NQF is looking for what are the opportunities to close some of the gaps around disparities, and you'll be able to look at that whenever you're looking at the gaps piece.
Okay. So as a group, then, when we meet, if we're going over these measures, then we want to know what the actual gaps are. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that we can make recommendations. All right, that's all I have to say about it.
So, Alexis, is there anything else? If not, then I think what you'll be looking for from us next is the information for phase two measures.
Yes, that's it.
Okay, Dr. Morris, Dr. Cortiana, anything in closure?
I would ask simply if Alexis could stay on the line at the end of the call. There's just a quick logistic thing I wanted to ask her.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, we're adjourned.
All right, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.